is actually a number, isn't it? A Google is a very large number with a large number of noughts. That's Mark Zuckerberg thought this would be a great idea for his business. No, it's not. It's not Mark. Who started Google? That's Facebook, isn't it? Who started Google? Dave Google. Thanks, Simon. So glad you're here. Dave, then, started Google. And this has grown into a global enterprise, hasn't it? Google is enormous. It's round the world. It's become a household name. A household name. I don't know if you know, but in the last 10 years, they started a project. So it's basically an information technology company. And they set about trying to scan every page in every book in all the major libraries in the world. So they wanted to go through all the shelves and collect all the data, all the information. And then we're producing a software program that would convert the information not just into scanned sheets, but actually be able to read the data and produce it into a program, a searchable program. Now, if you're following me at all, in short, what they were aiming at was an Uber library, a supercomputer with an Uber library. The largest single concentration of human knowledge in any one place in the whole wide world. And the idea of it was that people anywhere in the world, if you had access to a computer, could, of course, get into the mainframe. And, you know, even today, we can sort of type in a little thing into Google. What day was Napoleon Bonaparte born on? Bing, bing, bing. Up comes the information. And so this vast compendium of human knowledge was being concentrated. They were trying to do it. Now, it actually all came unstuck. Because the libraries began to object. Not only that they started to say, well, there's copyright infringement, what about the authors? You can't just copy people's work and use it and so on and so forth. But really at heart, they realized that they as libraries are centers of power, aren't they? If you've got knowledge is power. And if all this information was being exported out to Google, the libraries were going to be increasingly no longer the places where everybody turned and went, and these great concentrations of power. I'm talking about these things. I'm talking about knowledge, because at the beginning of the passage, chapter 2, verse 1, he says, I did not come to you with eloquence or superior knowledge. So I'm talking about the world's vast appetite for concentrating knowledge, because knowledge is power. And yet the Apostle Paul apparently is not interested in that kind of power, worldly power, human power. He's interested in the power of God, which is different. You know, today the word Google, I think I'm right in saying Google has now become a verb in the dictionary. To Google. And effectively, to Google doesn't necessarily mean to use Google's search engine. It means to seek to find knowledge or information immediately. When was Napoleon born? Bing, bing. I know. It's not the same as knowledge, is it? It's just information, this massive resource of information. So you can Google it. And those of you, how many people wear glasses? There's a few of you sunglasses, a few of you wear glasses here. You know about Google Glass? Yes? So glasses, this is not an advert for Google, by the way, all right? Google glasses, and they've got a little hard drive built into the side of your glasses, and a little projector, so that it projects the information, instead of onto your screen, onto your phone, it projects it onto your glasses. So as you're walking around, you can see everything, but you can also see the data in front of your eyes. So for example, I might walk into a meeting, and I've come to Roy's offices, and I think, I'm meeting this guy, Roy Euler. I've never met him before, so I quickly just, with a nod of my head, I can go through the search engine, I can find Roy Euler Enterprises Corporation, international giant, surveyors, international surveying giant, and find out who is their head honcho down there, and I'll read his biography. So as I go, oh, Mr. Euler, I know you're a keen golfer, I know you're a keen cricketer, or whatever. Not. Knowledge is power. And people always have wanted this. In the ancient world, in the time when this letter was written to the Corinthians, there were great libraries. There was the library in Alexandria, world-famous concentration of knowledge. There was Pergamon, which wasn't that far from Corinth. There was Ephesus, which wasn't that far from Corinth. These people amassed documents and knowledge, because if you've got knowledge, you've got power. People have to come to you. How do I do this? How do I find out? They have to come to you. It's the same today, isn't it? People for centuries have been going to Oxford, and they've gone to Cambridge. You get drawn into the orbit of where knowledge is concentrated, because knowledge is power. Now they're going to MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, or to Harvard Business School. People want to have the best universities in the world, because what is Harvard? It's a little two-bit town in Massachusetts somewhere, or wherever it is, on the eastern seaboard or whatever it is. But people go for there from all around the world, because they know, if I can get a degree from Harvard, if I can build myself my CV up and stuff like that, I'm going to be able to knock on somebody's door, and a door which would otherwise be shut to me, there is the assumption that that door will open, because I'll wave my Harvard business degree in front of their faces, and they'll go, oh, come in, mister. So and so and so and so forth. Knowledge is power. And Corinth was a new city. They hadn't been there very long. And they didn't have a great library. It was new money. They were building, people making their fortunes. They were climbing the greasy pole. They weren't sort of part of the establishment and all the rest of it. But to get their hands on knowledge, to get their hands on power, it's just like the way this wealth is one thing, but taste and knowledge and all these sort of things, they wanted to be respected. These are the things you need to be respected in the world. To be educated. Yeah, it's true to this day, isn't it, that people, you have the assumption, we put a lot of emphasis on getting people given the best possible education, because we think to ourselves, if they've got a good education, they'll be able to walk through those doors and take their place in the world. It means something to us, doesn't it? We want them to be secure. But it's just like wealth. The more you get, when you're sitting there on your fantastic yacht and you look across the harbour and there's somebody that's got an even bigger yacht than you, and you've just come back with your Harvard business degree, and then somebody else, they come in and they've just got, and even they've written 10 books, I don't know, a professor of, it's always, there's an inbuilt insecurity in this world. People want to be respected and have worth and value as if they're something, and they try these different means. I'm nothing against educational wealth, but if they become your God, if they become your source of your personal worth, they become idols, and they won't help you. They can't help you, because all that knowledge and all that wisdom and stuff like that, in the end, when we meet God, it's no defense. There's you, there's God, and your Harvard business degree. You've got nothing personal, by the way. No, not you, Simon. No, you. It's nothing against, if you've got Harvard business degree. I'm not having to go to Harvard here today, by the way, for those of you who've got Harvard business degrees here. But you can't wave it in front of God and say, here I am, make way. Or look at my qualifications, Lord. Do the world how I think. You can't tell God. You're never, 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 never going to impress him. You're never going to be smarter. You'll never know more. You'll never be more wise or understanding. We need to come to God humbly, don't we? And see, what was happening in this time, at the time which we're reading here in First Corinthians, people like Apollos and others, that the Jews of that period, they've been trying to take their religion, and they've been trying to sell it to the world. They've been trying to convert people to Judaism. They've been doing it like this because they knew that the world was interested in knowledge and sophistication. They were saying, we have knowledge, we have sophistication, we've got this fantastic Bible, we've got the wisdom of Solomon here, we've got an explanation on the beginnings of the earth, and so on and so forth. But the problem with trying to impress people with our religion, to impress people with our Christianity, is what we end up doing is trying to make our religion intellectually credible. We're trying going to impress people. We want to be respected, and we want to show. And the problem is that what you start to do is you start to sweep under the carpet all the little bits about our faith and our religion that are, if I can put it like this, there's just too much blood. There's rather a lot of blood in this book, have you noticed? And the Jews of that time, what they were doing, things like circumcision, if I can speak candidly, they were downplaying. That was our past. That was our barbarian past. That's how we were, but we're more sophisticated now. And there is a danger, isn't there, that out of an insecurity, we lose confidence in our faith and our Bibles, and we tend to downplay the bits that are less respectable because we want to be accepted. We want to be loved. We want to be welcomed. We want to be credible. Just in the same way as there are people, they feel that they haven't never had the education that they'd like, and they live in a society where if you haven't got certain degrees, if you hadn't been to university, you come into life feeling like you're less than everybody else. You're not less than anybody else. You're made in the image of God. But it can eat away at people, just like wealth, the lack thereof, can eat away at people. The same person with 50 quid in their pocket feels differently about themselves to the person with 50p in their pocket. It's the same person, and they feel differently about them because they feel their power is in their money, and it's not. The power is in the love of God, in who we are, who we've been made. That's the dignity which we've all been given, every single one of us. And we obviously want our kids to have a good education, and we want to keep pursuing education and all these sort of things. But the danger is, we think it's going to give us something which it doesn't. It thinks it will make us secure, and it doesn't make us secure. We end up with intellectual skeletons in our closet. We end hiding away the parts of ourselves that we feel we're ashamed of. We start leading a double life. But Christ can love you, all of you. And that's a wonderful thing, a transforming thing. And we all need the love of God, don't we? We need the love of God. Because the truth is, as we come to this passage in verse 2, we'll see that Christianity was never set out to make you respectable. What does he say he came, this rather crude, simplistic, and blood-soaked message? Christ crucified. Christ crucified. I mean, we perhaps have lost something of the power of some of those words. You know, crucified, it is the most shameful. To be crucified is to be utterly, utterly rejected and despised, outcast, hated. It's the worst thing that can happen to anybody. And it happened to the Christ, to the anointed one, the one set apart by God. And that message of a man sent by God to die a humiliating death is what he wanted to talk to them about. That piece of knowledge, that piece of information, that crude truth. There's nothing very flowery about it. Verse 3, you can see when he comes preaching to Corinth, and they want to be something. They want to be respected. They want to be wealthy. They want to be smart. They want to be educated. They want to be a part. They want to find their place in the world by their own efforts. And he comes to them to demolish all of that and say, you've got to find your place in Christ and Christ alone and him crucified. That's where you're going to find the love of God. That's where you'll find true security. And to come into the world and to talk like this, to take the world that's coming towards you, it's like coming, who's been to London of late and tried to go on the underground, and everybody comes steaming off the tube trains, steaming out, and you're standing there saying, go back, you're going the wrong way, going absolutely against the crowd, turn around, you've got it all wrong, Christ, go to Christ. To do that, what's it feel like? The Apostle Paul tells us what's it like to live like that. If you live like that yourself, you'll know, you'll recognize this. If you don't, here it is. I came to you in weakness, in fear, with much trembling. Scared out of his wits. Not because he's necessarily a fearful person, but from his experiences, he has had experience after experience after experience. As you stand there trying to turn the crowd around and go that way, half the time they will trample you underfoot and you get hurt. And nobody likes getting hurt. But Christ got hurt. Paul got hurt. Living for Christ, dot, 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 fill in the gaps. That's what it's like. Christ-like, being sent to suffer. You know, people, they look down on you. They disdain you. They think you're ridiculous, think you're foolish. Out of your tiny mind, you've lost your marbles. And they think they are something. They think they're something. They really do. But according to this, they are coming to nothing. They're going the wrong way. They're going the wrong way. And when you see Paul talking about this, he's talking about his confidence in carrying on living this kind of life, and he talks about it as a demonstration of the Spirit's power. The power that can keep you standing, speaking, living, going in the other direction, going against the crowd, suffering the things that you must suffer. With a smile, with joy. That's a miracle. That's the same power that raised Jesus Christ bodily from the dead, working in you. It's a miracle to live for Christ. Gordon Fee, whose commentary I was having a look at when I was, said, it's not the presenter, it's not the presentation, it's the Spirit's work. If you're converted, if people are converted, if people are won to Christ, it's not because of us and our presentation, is it? It's the one we're talking about and what he does. It's him. Him at work in our lives. Him at work in history. Him at work. It's God. The mainframe. You've got to come to God. You've got to come to God. It's one thing, isn't it? You know, Jesus didn't just talk about going to the cross. Many people say wonderful things. They make lots of promises. Ah, oh, he's going to do so and so. He did it. He did it. Paul didn't just talk, have a missions conference and call everybody there and have a prayer meeting. He went. And Christianity, something, it's a verb. Is that true? Christianity is a verb. Something you do. Or Google. To Google. If Google is a verb, then Christianity, if it's a verb, is to live this vulnerable, self-sacrificing life against the current of the world and its spirit, with your eye focused and fixed on God, the source of power and wisdom. I made that up. What made these people in Corinth Christians? Some fearful guy standing there just saying, you've got it wrong. It's not very nice to tell people they've got it wrong, is it? They don't like, have you noticed? But he did it. And some of them stopped for a moment, thought about it, listened, by the grace of God, inquired a few further questions, and found out about this Jesus, put their trust in him, and joined. And that's why the church was there. Not just persuasive words, persuasive deeds. That's fair enough, isn't it? Don't you think the world expects us to do as well as say? I think it's perfectly reasonable. And without works, our faith is dead, says James. Why are we Christians? Why are we Christians? Because there's a law saying you've got to be a Christian? Anybody here because the law says you should be a Christian? Anybody a Christian here because it's customary to be a Christian? It's in your family to be a Christian. Anybody like that? How about, there's a guy like the equivalent of ISIS in Iraq come with a machine gun and said, you've got to be a Christian. Anybody here under force and duress? No? If you're a Christian today, it's because you have seen the wisdom and the power of God in Christ Jesus, and the love of God has produced in you a love for God, and your life has been turned around and changed. Yes? Reasonable definition? It's God, isn't it, that does the work? It's God that does the work. It's amazing. Jesus, rejected by men, crucified, and yet it's been preached today all around the world. A carpenter who got crucified, and we're all talking about him to this day, 2,000 years later. It's God. God is doing this. What does the Spirit of God do? What does it do? Does it lift you above everybody else? Is that what the Spirit of God does? Does he lift you up? Do you become the elite? Christians, the elite people. See, that's the problem with wealth, isn't it? They say, it won't change me. I was quite touched by Adele, you know the singer Adele. She went and worked in a local record shop after she'd made millions. It's really quite cool. We're impressed, aren't we? When somebody's been successful and has money and yet seems to sort of keep their feet on the ground. It's a good thing, isn't it? But most of the time, a bit of money will change you. And if you've got money and you lose it, often that will change you too. Elitism, intellectual. We think we'll go off to college, we'll go off to university, and we won't change. We'll still be able to hang out with our friends. Once we've put on the uniform, we've got our degree, and we come back and we see the guys. And with the best will in the world, people change. People change. Christianity doesn't make us elitist, and it helps us to live our lives out before people, to walk before people. It's not an insider movement. We don't come get down and go native and get down with the kids and like they can't even tell the difference between us and anybody else because we're just so like them, we've lost our distinctiveness. And it doesn't raise us above everybody else, so we're the superior. And we're not separatists. We don't build our buildings like 1,000 miles from anywhere, so they have to approach us on dirt track after 3 days' journey. We don't really associate with them. It's being an outsider. Being prepared to live your life as an outsider, even in your own home. That's what Christ did. To be absolutely in the world. Absolutely in the world. But absolutely not of the world. And you need the power of God to do that. You need the power of God to live like that. Because the truth is, when you live like that, you are, humanly speaking, very vulnerable. Vulnerable, the Latin word vulnere, means to be wounded. People can hurt you. Jesus got hurt. Paul got hurt. If you live like this, people can hurt you. Nobody likes to be hurt. We want to defend ourselves. We want to build our walls. We want to have our education, our money, and all that sort of thing. Keep people at a distance. But that's not how Christianity calls us to live. It's quite something, isn't it? To be despised, to be rejected, to be hated, hurt, killed. Not stop talking about this Jesus. I would say that's a victorious life. Jesus, it says, gave his back to the smiter. Public beatings, you know. He said, there you are. And he said he gave his cheek to those who pluck out the beard. Here it is. He offered himself. That's a demonstration of the Spirit. That's power. That is real power, isn't it? Not the veneer of worldly power. When you change things in worldly terms, it all collapses. A life built on Christ, solid. 1 James 4:18, there is no fear in love. Perfect love casts out fear. Paul, again, Romans 8:35, 36. We're like sheep for the slaughter. Sheep for the slaughter. Anybody want to live like a sheep for the slaughter? That's the Christian life. But he goes on to say, but who can separate us from the love of Christ? Because sheep like that have a shepherd, and he has a stick. That's our confidence. He's our power. He's our strength. He's our salvation. The gospel is simple. Kind of. And that's when we get verse 6 here. Second 2 points are quite short. Verse 6. Simple does not mean it's simplistic. It doesn't mean it's kind of like fetid and dumbed down. There's plenty of that around, isn't there? But lacking depth. It doesn't mean we haven't got anything to think about or something challenging to get our teeth into. On the contrary, it's not all just about rugged heroics, is it? It's about having a deep spiritual life. Deep spiritual life. It's not that there's more than the gospel. The gospel is it, but it is so deep. You can just think about it. And you suddenly realize that before the world was made, he had his salvation plan for you already hatched and planned. I find that thought amazing. That I'm going to have a new body. And that body will endure into eternity. That's an amazing thing to think about. There are such depths to the gospel. You think about the love of God. How high, how deep, how wide. You've got this lifetime and beyond to plumb the depths. The love of Christ. The love of Christ. These poor Corinthians, they've been so duped into getting back into this intellectualism. Nothing wrong with having thought, being thoughtful and deep, but intellectualism or a mysticism, as if somehow the gospel was there, the surface of it all, but beneath there's some hidden mystery, and there's a group of us in the church here who know. The rest of you, you're very sweet, love you in the Lord, and hopefully over time you will be initiated. And then you'll know. And when you think you know, then you'll realize there's another tier of people in the church who are even deeper than them. And they know even more. And one day you too might be in the inner sanctum. But the problem is the inner sanctum is empty. Because Christ is our all in all. It's all there. It's up front. And all you have to do is just pray about it and think about it and read your Bible. So, the bearer, he talks about a secret, doesn't he? He does say it is a bit of a secret knowledge, verse 7. It is a secret. I'll tell you who it's a secret to, people who don't believe. If you don't believe, it's all gobbledygook, isn't it? Absolute rubbish. Isn't it fascinating? I find this absolutely fascinating and simultaneously utterly tragic. These incredibly intelligent, powerful, worldly people, and you listen to them talking about Christianity, and they're talking absolute rubbish. They haven't got the faintest idea what this faith is all about. And it's not me just standing on my high horse about it. I mean, you listen to them, you just think, you haven't even got the rudimentaries in place. You seem to understand world affairs or something. And actually, what concerns me is that I sort of think, well, if they haven't understood this, how on earth are they fully equipped to do the other things and preside over the other things? It's a very unsettling experience when you think how much influence such people have, and you listen to people chattering away on Radio 4 and all the rest of it. They've been invited onto Radio 4. They don't know anything. Just simply because they have not started at the base camp of faith. And so consequently, they look at it all wrong. They look at it all wrong. And their diplomas will not penetrate the truth. When Jesus was crucified, the people who did the crucifying, the presiding councils, you know, they were educated and powerful and worldly people. Very capable people. Very capable people. You got it absolutely wrong. Absolutely wrong. Anybody ever said to you, I admire your faith? It must be nice to have a faith. Anybody said something similar like that to you? Bit of a crutch to lean on, you know, something nice, bit of a comfort, all the rest of it. Looking forward to heaven. See, but that's fine, isn't it? We've got all those things, definitely, but I also have to watch decent, nice, kind, intelligent, cultured people on their high horses riding over the cliff into the abyss every single day. And I don't like that view. It breaks my heart. That's the flip. That's the flip side, isn't it? How? And yet, some of us are very simple folk, very ordinary people. And yet, we can stand before the people of this world who are so smart and wise, and we wonder at their ignorance. And when we just talk simply about the things of faith, they're like, oh, how do you know such things? There's a wonderful testimony you can read about very ordinary people who just spoke a word in the presence of quite high and lofty people, and people will stop and think, where did they know such things? Who taught them? Do you remember what they said about the disciples? These are not educated men, but they've been with Jesus. They could, because he can take simple people and make them wise, give you a wisdom. This is the important knowledge. You won't find this on Google. It's not on Google. This power will not be given to you there. The information's out there, though. It's quite useful. I do use it. It's not a dig. You've got to come to God. You've got to come to God. I would love it if the Holy Spirit made me good at maths. Or DIY. Or gardening. He has helped me in those areas a little. But the real thing is he's shown me the heart of God. The heart of God! The heart of God! The will of God! The mind of Christ! Amazing. Amazing. Wonderful. Such things. Such things. That's the glory of the Lord, isn't it? He's given me his spirit. And he makes very ordinary people with a wonderful wisdom. You've got a wonderful wisdom, Christians. A wonderful, wonderful wisdom. And you're going to stand by, and verse 16 says, you're going to watch people thinking they can tell God what to do and how they should do. Run the world, and why did you do this, and you got all that wrong, and they do, don't they? They look down on God and criticize. They'd like to give him a lesson in being God. God, school starts today. I'm the teacher. Firstly, being nice, playing fairly, being particularly nice to me and my family. But the mind of Christ says, not my will, but yours be done. Not my will, yours be done. That's the mind of Christ. And that's the mind that Paul's talking about, that took him into perilous and difficult situations, made him vulnerable, will take us into perilous and vulnerable situations where we are vulnerable. But Christ, God, is our protection and our defense. Well, think we're bonkers. Let's see if we can persuade them otherwise. Not by being smarter or cleverer, but pointing them to Jesus, the wisdom of God. You got the mind of Christ? You got the mind of Christ? You do. You've got the mind of Christ. It says, I read it in the Bible today. You've got the mind of Christ. You've got the mind of Christ? You do. You've got the mind of Christ. I read it in the Bible. It's here. You've got the mind of Christ. Rejoice. Let's sing to his praise.